I'd like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Rick S. from Poway.
My name's Rick. I'm an alcoholic. And thank you, Damien, for asking me to speak here. Thank you to all my lovely friends that, on short notice, were able to come out here and support me tonight. You know, I'm truly blessed to have people in my life that care enough to be here for me. It is intimidating to stand up here and look out at all your pleasant faces. I was fortunate during the break, we were able to pray, you know, that God can speak through me and carry a message of depth and weight this evening. It's a little intimidating for me to be up here last week. I watched one of my friends absolutely melt down up here last week. And she's been catching it all week because of it. I promise I won't call anybody out. Feel free to text during my share. Is there a big book that I could use while I'm up here? Yeah, my crutch is the big book. Doesn't matter, man. As long as it's got words, we can use it. Welcome to all the newcomers. You guys got a lot of newcomers here. I love that. My home group, you know, I have a home group. I have a sponsor. I got people that are waiting for me. I got sponsees that call me. I return their phone calls. I have a workshop. I run a meeting. I'm heavily involved in this thing, you know, and I'm sober. Newcomers, you know, if there's one thing that I ever wish to do, there's a part in the book that it says that we get this, like, special privilege that by becoming sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, by knowing the nature of the affliction that we suffer from, and by having a solution to it, and using that solution, that it puts us in a position that we're able to help somebody who has no hope. Unlike anybody else. Unlike their family, their children, judges, police, all these people that step in and try and intervene, we've been blessed with the opportunity to touch them because of our shared experience. I take that very seriously. So welcome to all the newcomers. And I'll try and speak to you. I grew up in this neighborhood. This is where I got drunk, man. Like, I know all the corners where people crash cars, where I got into car accidents, the biggest parties. I lived on Marjoram, and I was the kid whose mom died when I was in my senior year, and dad took off. And so all I got was, like, a big check, and I had a gas card and a car and my 16-year-old brother, and I was 17 at the time. And basically, we were the house that everybody could party at. I was watching that movie Project X with my son. It's about these kids that throw this big party and end up burning down the neighborhood. And the party's really starting to go. And my son goes, "Did you ever throw a party like this, Dad?" And I don't lie to my son. I tell my son the truth. I go, "You know, honestly, I threw a party, and my father was actually home for this. He allowed us to move all the furniture out." This was for my 17th birthday. We moved all the furniture out of the house, took the drapes down, the curtains down, brought in the DJ, lighting system, smoke, all this shit. And, you know, and the only deal was is that you could not drink inside the house. So what did we have? We had like 300 people up and down my block drinking out in front with like 500 people inside the house. And the helicopter came. We're watching this movie, and like 2 minutes later in the movie, a helicopter comes up over the top of this party. So, anyway. Let's get into alcohol. I have that story, and I do not share my story of my childhood very often because I think a lot of times when stories for me, it gets confused with that was the problem. That what happened to me is why I'm an alcoholic today. And it's not what happened to me. It's the way that I perceived it. All kinds of crappy things happen. People have things that happen just like me in their childhood, and they're not alcoholics. You know? There's delusions that I had to build up. There's stories that I had to make about what happened. There's decisions about how I was going to react to those things. There is defense mechanisms that I built and held on to long after they didn't work that created such discomfort in my life that eventually alcohol was my only solution. But it's not the event. So, you know, I preface it by saying that. Now I'll tell you how screwed up my childhood was. Okay? So I had five moms before I was 21 years old. Okay? My birth mother put me up for adoption at birth. I was placed in a foster home for 2 years. This is 1968. I'm a black kid in Minnesota. If you don't know what that means there's no other black people. As Chris Rock said, Prince and Kirby Puckett. And both of them weren't around then. I wasn't able to be, people like to adopt babies, and I wasn't able to be adopted right away because I was born with a congenital heart defect, and they don't want to give a family a baby that's going to die on them. So they hold you around, they make sure that you're going to be healthy, and just before my second birthday, they put me up for adoption, and I was adopted. So that's mom three, and I'm not even 2 years old yet. I lived in the same foster home with a mother, and the woman had five children, five daughters that lived in this home with them, and I was very well treated. I had none of the, like, attachment disorders or weird things from not being touched or cared for or loved. So I was clearly loved during that time. I was adopted by a white family in 1970. My mom tells the story, you know, it was awkward. And I'm not going to share about it from the awkward perspective from what it was awkward for me. But, like, my mom didn't know how to comb my hair. So we lived in northeast Minneapolis. And at the time, an all-pro lineman named Carl Eller lived on our block. Okay? So my mom, this, like... You know, she was a social worker in inner city of Philadelphia after she graduated from college. You know, this was a woman that was driven to serve. And she was not a hippie, but a hippie. She predated the hippies. She was the people that, like, were getting liberal before the hippies became a movement that was, like, cool and fun to do. So this white lady goes walking up the street to knock on Carl Eller's door. You know, boom, boom, boom. And, you know, this dude's the size of a house. I mean, Carl, big dude. And she starts asking him questions about how do I raise this little black kid. And he just looks at her and goes, just love him. You know, just love him. You know, and that's what she did to the best of her ability. You know, other situations that she had to confront. You know, I was a kid that ran off. Man, I was always moving. They never gave me drugs to slow me down, but I was always that, like, borderline case, like, maybe we should give him drugs. So I would run off in stores and do all this stuff. They had to lock me into my room from the outside because at 2 years old, they found me one time in the cupboards above the refrigerator. So I would go into stores, and my mom decided, well, she was going to get this harness to hold me on the store, but she felt so uncomfortable, this white lady walking around with this little, like, kid. That she only did it one time, and she got rid of the leash. That's a true story, I swear to God. We moved from Minnesota, and my dad was one of these guys that, like, would turn businesses around, like, they're all jacked up, and they'd be in receivership, and he was a financial analyst, and he would come out, and he was a working guy, you know, he's those guys that got up, he wore those shitty, ugly suits that they wore in the 70s, and he had a mustache, and, you know, he was just square as shit, you know, he was this Midwestern kid that grew up in a small town. He tells me the story about the first time that he ever saw black people was that they went to visit some relatives in South Dakota. So he was up in Crookston, which is on the border of Fargo, near North Dakota, near the Canadian border. It's basically a potato farming town. And they had to drive to South Dakota. And while they're driving through the fields of this, they saw black people sitting on the porch of a house. And, like, I don't know if you remember when you're a kid and you're driving, you're like, cow! Or horses! And you get all excited. They were driving in the car, and it was like black people. because he had never seen this. I mean, this guy was stretching the bounds of who he was by the time he's adopting this little kid. We moved out. We followed him around. I mean, he was one of those guys that he worked all the time to provide for our family. I don't remember him really having friends. I knew he had guys at work. You know, we'd go to work with him, and you'd meet the guys from work, or they'd have a barbecue on Memorial Day, and it'd be all the people from his office would come. These guys from his office would come. He would maybe golf once every 3 months and was always with guys from work. It wasn't like he hung out with the people in the neighborhood. He coached my basketball team, my little league teams, and things like this. But he was the guy that worked. And he was a good role model, and he was a good provider. You know, if you would have asked me the story when I was 13, I would have told you that he beat the shit out of me and treated me different than my brother, and I had all these things on how he was not a good father. That's just not true. It was just convenient for me to look at him in that way. It was convenient for me to poke out all of the flaws that he had. And I understand it today because I felt so flawed all the time. The first time that I ever used a mind-altering thing was in fifth grade. My mom switched me from schools all the time. So I had these five moms. My adopted mom ends up dying when I'm 16. My dad remarries 2 years after that. He's divorced again 2 years after that. And then he's finally remarried to the woman that he's with today. And they've been together for about 20 years. So that completes the loop on that, and I'll set that to the side. But we moved to San Diego, and schools became a big thing in my life. So, like, I had gone to this Montessori school in Minneapolis. We moved to Arizona. It was a short gig for my dad, so I moved into another school. When we moved to San Diego, I moved to another school. I went to Cleveland Elementary, right over here, you know, Brenda Spencer. I don't like Mondays. Shoot 'em up. I went to that elementary school for a year. My mom heard about a math science program in Encanto, so they started bussing me off to Encanto to go to the math science program. I went to that program for most of that year. In the last 2 weeks of that year, my dad took a job up in Los Angeles, so we moved up into the San Fernando Valley. I remember walking into that class. There's 2 weeks left in school. Like, you think my parents would just be able to say, let me slide, you know? But they checked me into the school. I remember walking into that school, and one of the kids, in his innocence, says, Marcus now has a friend. Marcus was the only other black kid in the school. You know, this idea that people were different was real, you know, and it wasn't why I'm an alcoholic. I used to milk the whole black kid thing for all it was worth. I love sharing about this because very early on, I was already in trouble, right? I couldn't get stuff right in school. I would test 2-3 grades ahead so they could never fail me, but I couldn't turn in homework assignments. I would never be able to finish projects on time. I'd always be the guy on the last night that's like working until midnight, and it would always come up short. I just couldn't get it together. I just could not get it together. And it wasn't for lack of wanting to or anything like that. Like, I always wanted to be the kid. Like, I did everything in the world to look like that, like, so nobody knew what my grades were, and everything outside looked like everything was going great. But my life was really kind of a mess underneath it. Nothing was really working right. And that started from a very young age. I started doing some things like fighting and stealing, shoplifting, things like that. And immediately, you know, the social worker mom's idea is, well, let's get him into therapy. So I'm in therapy at like 13. And I learned really quick that I would sit across from these nice white ladies and, you know, they ask you what's going on, and I'd sit around for a while, and I'd tell them all about everything, and then I'd pull, I just feel so different. And their liberal hearts would break. And they would go to mom like, there's a real problem here. And I knew I was clear, you know? And until the next time something big happened and they had to send me back to it. One time they took me to Tough Love. I was probably about 14 years old. This was insane. Tough Love was a crazy place because you'd go to this place and they put all the parents in one room and they talk about how to be tough, you know, and how you got to quit enabling your kids and do all this stuff. And then they put all the kids in another room, and I learned more shit to do in Tough Love from the kids that were in there. My parents came out of it really quickly. They didn't find much after about 2 or 3 months of going to it. They're like, this isn't going to work. Most of these kids, like, were running away and doing stuff like this. And my dad, I remember my dad saying to me, we're not going this place anymore. He goes, I am completely certain you will never run away. He's all, you are far too spoiled to try and live on the street. And it was true. I mean, I wasn't going anywhere, you know. I had a nice life. I was a really good athlete. And I think athletics, more than anything, kept some balance in my life. You know, out on the field, I could lose myself. You know, I was the kid that if I had a 9 o'clock game, I was up at 4:30. And I was dressed and ready to be out that door. And the butterflies were flying. And I knew that when I would get on that field, I was a star. And that people, I could do things that other kids couldn't do. I had no fear when I was out there. I knew exactly what I was doing. And if I didn't, I'd make it up. And it was even better then. You know? And it didn't matter what the sport was, whether it was baseball or basketball or soccer. I lettered in my sophomore year in baseball and soccer. I played tennis competitively. That was a really funny one because there wasn't any black tennis players. You know, Arthur Ashe had long since retired. And about when I was 13 or 14, Yannick Noah showed up, and he was a black guy that won, like, the French Open and did some stuff for a couple of years. But, yeah, I was like a novelty. I'd go to these country clubs and tennis clubs and things like that, and I'd show up, and they'd be like, what the hell? And I'd smoke their little white kid, you know. I had so much, I felt so comfortable there. You know, I moved down to San Diego when my mom got sick with cancer. I was 15 years old. I was a year ahead. So I graduated high school when I was 17, and I wasn't going to turn 18 until November. So, like, when I started my first semester of college, I was still 17. Like, I remember going into the junior year. I was in my junior year going to homecoming, having to, like, beg a ride because I still didn't drive. I was immature, you know? Like, so I could do all these things athletically, but, like, even just I realize it now when I had kids. Like, I have a son that has a birthday on September 23rd, and immediately when they ask the question, are you going to start him early, are you going to keep him back, I was like, there's no way I'm starting him early. You know, there's no way I'm going to start him early. I felt ridiculous going off to college, and I was like, I couldn't do things that other kids could do at 18, and I felt uncomfortable by it. You know, I drank. When sports kind of dried up, I moved down here, you know, trying to transfer schools. And at that time, I was primarily a baseball player by this time. Just by absolute chance, the team that I played for up in Los Angeles had faced the team that I was coming to here in San Diego in the regional championships to go to the Pony World Series the year prior to that. And Patrick Henry's players, Eric Karros and all those guys from that day, they lost, and our team went on to the World Series. So when I showed up here, they didn't like me much. They had a team that was amazing, that actually won the championship that year, my first year here. But they had no need for a second baseman down here that they didn't know for 5 years. I don't think I would have taken a new player onto that team. It was absolutely a phenomenal team. So that was the end of playing sports. I showed up at the school in the second semester of Patrick Henry, and I wasn't going to play sports, but I knew that I needed something. So I knew nobody at this school, so I decided I'm going to run for president of the school, like 1 month into being at the school. And it was like a 2-week campaigning thing. You did something on closed circuit TV, like a speech, and you put up posters and all this stuff. And a bunch of guys, I knew some people that lived down here. That's why we moved down here. We have family friends down here. My mom's best friend lived here, and they had two kids that were at Patrick Henry. So they came up with the idea. They had already been experimenting with drinking a bit more than I had. And they came up with the idea, let's throw a giant bonfire down at Crown Point. And we went and got like five kegs, and I had this big van, and I drove all this stuff down to the beach. And I lost the election, but everybody in the school knew me by after that party. And, you know, I don't remember having the feeling those first times that I drank that this was the solution. But I know when you coupled it with that I could get the same feeling I was getting from playing sports, like the acclaim and notoriety and all of that, that together was enough. And I started drinking and using. And, it took off so quickly for me. You know, within a year, I had experimented with crystal meth. Whoo! That was good. But it wasn't like the alcohol. The alcohol I could always get. Like, it was really convenient, and it took it off. And I didn't have these, like, weird effects that I had from that stuff. You know, like days of not sleeping. I used to say, like, my three favorite things were sex, eating, and sleep. And in order to do crystal, I had to give up all three of my favorite things. So I learned that that changed a little later, but one of those I got back on crystal. But I wasn't having a lot of sex at 16 anyway. Yet. So, you know, I started the drinking stuff, and I never was a temperate drinker. I came out of the gate, and I was hammered. And I went through my entire life being drunk. I was at a... When I got the call that they needed somebody to fill in and speak today, I was sitting at a party watching a guy, like, rip a bong hit over here. There was a guy that had just gashed his leg open all hammered. Everybody's drinking all around me. I was sitting at a table eating some food, and the entire thing was littered with empty shot glasses and beer cans. And today I can sit in that in absolute peace. I wouldn't if I could. It's a promise. And I was always the guy, even at that party with all of that stuff going on, I identified right away who I was. I was the one guy that was sloppy, drunk, slobbering all over the place, banged his leg up, bleeding. I was the one guy that was out of control all the time. It wasn't until in sobriety that I realized that I was out at a bar. I went out with people in sobriety really early on. I went dancing. I got sober up at the Palo Alto Club. They had a big social aspect to it. And they took me out, and we did things together. So I was in places with other people that had long-term sobriety early on. But I remember the first time that I was actually really comfortable being in there when I started looking around outside of the people that I was focused on that were sober. And I'm going, there's only like three dudes that are really wasted in here. Did everybody stop getting drunk? Because I swear to you, everybody was hammered like me when I was drinking. And then it dawned on me, no, dude, you were the ass. You were one of those three guys that was insanely drunk. Not kinda, insanely drunk. Always. I'm going to go to, you know, that's kind of like how I got there. You know, I did all of the crazy things. I have gotten on the wrong plane and ended up in the wrong country. I have stayed on business trips 5 days longer because I'm drinking and smoking crack in the hotel room on the company's credit card. I have taken clients out and dropped 10 grand in strip clubs on alcohol and drugs. I have done every unimaginable thing you can do. I cheated on my wife. I cheated on every person that was in my life. I lied. I stole from my jobs. I stole from people in my family. I lied to everyone around me. No one had any clue who I was. They didn't even know who I was one day to the next. I'd be this guy today and I'd be that guy the next. I've done every single disgusting thing that you could have actually do. I did do one thing, is that I went to law school and I was able to hold stuff together just enough that I was able to buy myself out of almost every problem that I got into. You can go a long time in this place. You don't even have to be very smart. They always mix this money and intelligence. Screw that. You can be a complete dumb shit with a lot of money, and you can stretch out this disease for a long time. Okay? It's not about your intelligence. It's just about your financial staying power. So where did I get to? Why do I need Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, I lost a job, you know, just in the regular course of events. I lost, you know, I got laid off. It wasn't like I drank my way out of the job, you know. Big, monstrous layoffs, you know, giant company, Fortune 50 company. The drinking was already way out of hand. My marriage was in an absolute shambles. We kind of held it together for a little while, and she decided that, you know, I wasn't worth the effort anymore. You okay, little guy? There you go. So I got another job, and that with a startup, and it really didn't work. But what was great about this job was it was in the music industry, and they brought me in as this expert on technology. I didn't know anything about music, but I knew about the wireless sector, and I had been a strategist in that market for like 10 years. So I knew how to get this new this new product of music that they had of unlicensed artists onto phones and into carriers. And this was very attractive to them. And they knew nothing about what I did, so they couldn't question anything I was doing. And it was the music industry. Drugs and alcohol, no one ever questioned if I was doing blow in the bathroom at the office. You know, I would show up, and they honestly had a bar in our office that I could drink like madmen. You know, I could show up in the morning at 10 o'clock hungover, and I could drink. And I would do, and that's what I did. You know, I just kind of stumbled through the day. The company imploded. We spent all the investors' money. I mean, the guys that I was working with were just as big of drug addicts and drunks as I was. It was a complete mess. And I found myself out of that, and I got picked up by another big company out of Austin. And they decided they were going to not just make computers, but they were going to make cell phones, and they needed people that had experience doing that. So they hired like 250 people from my old company to come down there and do this. And I had been there for about a month, and they asked me to come down to speak to they were like influencers on the web. These are people that have blogs with over 10,000 people, and they had lovers and haters. So these are people that hated the company's products and then people that loved the company's products. And they were bringing me in to show them the shiny new phone. I was going to do this whole wireless strategy song and dance. And I moved out of my house. We had been living together separated. I moved into my new apartment the day before I was taken off to go on this trip to Austin. And I remember getting dropped off at the airport. And there was a couple, and they were on their way home, and they were at the bar, and they were drinking shots of tequila. So I started joining them doing shots of tequila at the bar. I traveled my entire life in business, and I had always made it a rule. It was one of those things that I would never do, is drink when I flew. And for some reason that morning, I didn't even give it a second thought. It was a Sunday. I was traveling on my own time, but I was traveling. The problem was is that I had this fancy new device with me that nobody knew about, so I wanted to open my mouth and tell people how special I was. And I get hammered on this, and I start talking to the flight attendants when we're still on the tarmac to give me a couple double doers. And I drank a bunch of them. I really don't remember much that happened on that thing. But however, I do have all these pictures that are on this fancy device of me in the back with all the flight attendants. Some awkward situation. Clearly, they weren't comfortable with the way I was behaving. You know, I've been through 2 years of the toughest financial time. I've gone through a split. This is 2009. Okay, so there's not jobs out there, and I'm sitting with a $150,000 salary job, and I'm about to drink it down the drain, and I don't even see it coming. I wake up in the plane in Austin, and there's not another person on the plane. And there's two Austin police officers standing over me, and my heart drops. I have no idea what I've done. They don't say much to me. They didn't handcuff me, so being a lawyer, I knew this was good. They walked me through the airport, put me in a cab, and sent me on my way. We're pulling out of the airport, and the first thing, and I'm like, woo! You know, I'm safe. Where's the closest liquor store? You know, that phenomenon of craving that they talk about, I experienced that in so many ways. You know, I was the guy that would sit, that night continued, and I ended up drunk. I walked into the meeting in the morning. I got to the hotel. I bought a six-pack of beer. I walked into the hotel. I noticed that there was a bar over there. I thought, well, if I can still buy drinks here, I don't need to drink what I bought. I can take these up with me. So I went into the bar, and a lot of the people that were there, the haters and the lovers, were in there, and I proceeded to go in there and tell them what idiots they were for 3 hours drinking in the bar. And I showed up at the meeting the next morning. People weren't talking to me on the bus ride over there, like all these people. I was trying to be nice. And they weren't really talking to me. I didn't know what was going on. I was still hammered. I mean, I drank till like 5 in the morning. And I'm trying to hold it all together in my suit. And, you know, at 9 o'clock, the HR woman shows up during the first break and escorts me out of the building. I went back to the hotel. My manager called me, and I said to her, she said, Rick, you know, clearly something's wrong, and we need you to go home now, and we'll call us when you get back. I woke up the next day in the hallway. The manager of the hotel woke me up in the hallway. I don't know why I was sleeping in the hallway. I stayed in Austin for an additional 5 days, and they had no idea where I was. The company didn't know where I was. My family didn't know where I was. I didn't know where I was. And I lost that job. I didn't even know that all I had to do was go on disability. That would have been fine. That they couldn't have fired me. I was so lost in this thing. I'm like, I'm going to figure out how to handle this situation. I'm just going to have to throw away this job and find the next. But, you know, it got worse the second I was done with that, because despair really set in on me this time. And the idea that this was going to happen, or I was going to be able to recover from this, I didn't have that same bounce back. That resilience that I had had my entire life had left me. About 4 months later, I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I woke up one morning. There was a girl that was in my room, and she was all bright and chipper, and I was getting dressed at the foot of the bed, and she said, what are you going to do today? Like, we're going to go hang out or something. And I told her, I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she's like, what? And I just walked out of the room. I lived in an apartment complex. I walked next door to the guy. I didn't know anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I knew that my next-door neighbor had been forced to do Gamblers Anonymous because he had ripped off the casino that he worked out as a gambler. So I knew that he had done Gamblers Anonymous, so I went over to him and I asked him if he would take me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd already been tracking this on the internet for weeks, and I looked for everything else. I looked at the moderation guys. I looked at all these other people. I really did not want to not drink. I just didn't want all the trouble. I wanted to be better. When I walked over there and I asked him that, you would have thought like the heavens had opened up. This poor guy had been suffering with this. I mean, I was a bad drunk. I'm not the guy that doesn't bug you. I come in at 3 o'clock in the morning with 16 people, and they don't leave for 3 days, and your 15-year-old kid is seeing the girls coming in and out, and it's not pleasant to live near me and my disease. Like, I don't do it halfway. I walked into that meeting that first day at the Poway Awano Club. 10 minutes, thank you. This is perfect because we're going to get into recovery. You know, the second day I was there, this guy walked over and dropped a matchbook on my thing, and he said, "Give me a call." And after the meeting, a guy came up to me and said, "If you're serious about getting sober, you're going to call that guy tonight." And I did call that guy that night, and he asked me one question. He goes, "Are you willing to go to any lengths?" And I lied and said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, what do we have to do?" He said, "Well, all you got to do is you got to meet me over at the Starbucks at 10 o'clock on Saturday, and we're going to read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then we're going to go to a meeting. And in between now and Saturday, you're going to call me every day between 4 and 7 o'clock." And so I did that. And I kept doing that, and I met with him every Saturday. And I went to meetings 2-3 times a day. I had to go to meetings 2-3 times a day because I had no other place that I felt safe. And fortunately, I had a job at that time. I was consulting for a company that nobody was watching what I was doing. So as long as I had a project that was a long-term project, so I knew I was going to be able to finish the project, but it gave me the flexibility to be able to leave when I needed to leave. That's how I found the Little Italy men's meeting on Fridays. I would sneak out of the office at 12 and go to the men's Little Italy meeting. And sometimes I would just drive all the way back up to Poway and go to the Poway Alano Club. Or I'd go at 3:30 up there, and then I would go to the 6. On Sundays, I would go at a 7 a.m. meeting. I'd go to 1 o'clock. I'd go to the 6 o'clock. I'd get out of the 6 o'clock, and I'd race over to Aurora and go to the 7:30 meeting because the last thing I wanted to do was be alone. I worked all the way through the steps, and when I got done at about 7 months, they said, "You can do anything you want to do now." So I said, "Well, the first thing I got to do is I got to put my life back together." So the first odd girl that walked in to the room, that's size 0DD, I said, "That fits the picture of what I need my life to look like." And I jumped into that. I should say that I met her. She was an inpatient at Aurora at the time. That didn't work out. You just, so we but it went downhill bad. I mean, this wasn't a good downhill. You know, it turned out she had other things besides this going on. Some of us come in with mental and, you know, other types of mental and emotional disorders, and she was a borderline personality disorder, which is very dangerous. And I look at that today, and I think, what a disservice I did to that woman. Just an absolute disservice that I did to her by getting involved in a relationship with her at that point. Like, injecting myself into her life, this absolute disaster, and blocking her from the ability to actually get some relief. I ended up, I moved in with her at the threat of her calling the police if I showed up at the house. I found myself back in the Poway Alano Club parking lot with 2 duffel bags of clothes and a surfboard. And there was this guy that used to hang out around the Poway Alano Club. And he had done this, and he would always be spouting off about this way to do the work. And he would stand in the parking lot. I always thought he was such a tool because he would only pick out, like, the hottest-looking girls to, like, go up to and talk to and all this stuff. And he'd be screaming at the window, "There's no recovery up there! They're all going to drink! There's no recovery!" He was a little bit of a zealot, you know, and I didn't want anything to do with him. But the way the circumstances worked out on this, I ended up renting a room from this guy. Now, I'm 45 years old. I've been an executive most of my adult life. I got two kids that I have custody of 50% of the time, and now I'm renting a room in the back of this less than stellar place where we basically housed people that were trying to kick heroin. That was, like, there was always a guy on the couch or in the extra bedroom that was pissing the sheets or whatever, trying to kick heroin. And I rented the back room like a roommate, not somebody that was in need of his help. And it was the greatest blessing of my life. And he introduced me to the work in a different way. And he showed me that if I practiced the circle and the triangle, that my life could be whole. He talked to me about things like the sunlight of the spirit. He shared with me promises in the books that weren't on the wall. You know, the greatest promises for me are the 10-step promises. You know, at this time I will have returned to sanity. You know, that the drink problem will have been removed without any effort. You know, I think about those promises a lot more than all that other stuff. I mean, I can really wrap myself around. I can get my ego so caught up in 9-step promises that I'm nowhere close to even understanding what they're about. So I started doing the work, going through the book, line by line, turning statements into questions and asking myself what was going on. I'll tell you, like, for me, the biggest thing in the world, and this is directed to the newcomer, the biggest thing in the world is for you to understand whether or not you are one of us. And no one in this room can tell you that. You can tell yourself. And there's 50% of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is dedicated to you developing an understanding of whether or not you fit in that category. You guys have all heard people from my fellowship share about this, so I'm not going to go into it the same way that it always gets talked about. But what I'm going to talk about today is the doctor's opinion. Dr. Silkworth ran the hospital in Manhattan. You know, he's a guy that lost his job during the Depression. He took on this job. He worked with more alcoholics. They estimate 40 to 50,000 alcoholics. Like, this guy is bigger than anybody in addiction today. And these are not alcoholics that, like, I got in trouble with the judge. My husband's sick of my Xanax and wine habit. These were people that are dying. Like, they had an entire ward at this hospital of people that were wet brain. Like, their bodies are still totally functioning, and they're just sticking alcohol in them so that they don't go into physical withdrawal from it. And their bodies live for decades up there with nothing. They're gone. They're completely gone. And they would drag these people off the street, and people would drop them out of alleys, and the cops would drop them in there. And this guy, he says straight out, like, there's nothing we could do for him. There's nothing we could do for him. And Bill Wilson was one of those guys that was in there. He was on his third trip there when he had his experience. You know, and he'd been given a little bit, he'd been exposed to this. He'd had the approach. Ebby had made the approach on him. But he has this experience when he's in there. This is you talk about the power of what has happened with this, and you talk about desperation. Forget your desperation for a second. Think about the desperation of a doctor that's done more of this than anything, that he's so desperate that this guy that he's declared hopeless comes to him and says, "Doc, I got the answer." And the doc goes, "Okay, go share it with everybody else." Think about that for a second. A doctor, these guys that are always got this God complex, and this drunk that he's declared hopeless comes up to him and says, "I got a solution." How desperate would you have to be to allow this guy wander the halls that he's got the solution to fix you guys, because I have nothing to offer you. Nothing to offer you. I'm the top in my field and I have nothing to offer you. Do you hear that? Nothing. Carl Jung talks about it. I have nothing to offer you. The greatest psychiatrists, the top doctors, nothing to offer you. So we're going to give it to this drunk guy that has some idea that came to him in his bed while he's detoxing. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a very difficult time with the whole coming to believe portion. And I'm going to finish on this because I think it's of critical importance. This program, it says in the first paragraph of We Agnostics that if when you try to stop, you can't, or if when you're drinking, you don't seem to be able to control how much you drink, then you're probably one of us. Period. Okay. You're probably alcoholic. If you suffer from this, then you are going to require a spiritual solution. That's a hard thing to grasp. I had gone through all of this stuff with the idea of I can do this stuff without ever having to grasp the idea of a God. And, you know, there's something in this book. I was talking with Tyler, and I quoted this portion, you know, that it's we're wide open. That there's no rules here. That our God is wide open to everybody. That it's all inclusive, never exclusive. That you can find your own concept. And this is how powerful this is for me, because if you go to the end of Bill's story, when he's sitting with Abby, and Abby talks to him about God thing, and he almost buys into it. He sees Abby. He's like fresh-faced and glowing. This guy, something's happened to him. Everything's been rearranged. He's not even preaching at me about this stuff. He's simply sharing what happened to him. And Bill is on the precipice of jumping in. And he goes, whoa. You almost got me. You almost sold me on this religion thing. And Abby says probably the most profound line stated in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we wouldn't have our fellowship if it wasn't for this. What if you chose a God of your own conception? And with that, and becoming willing to do the rest of the work, I've been sober. Thank you for letting me share.